LA Talk Radio thanks you for being a listener. Did you know you too can host your own radio show with us? Go to our site at latalkradio.com or email info@latalkradio.com right now and start your show today.
Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Matt Polacek, only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of Answers for the Family. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza, and I'll be flying solo today. My co-host, Dr. Matt Polacek, is focusing on his work as director of the Hazelton Betty Ford Center here in Los Angeles. Now, for those of you that have been listening, sending in questions and comments, thank you so much. And please continue to help spread the word that every Monday from 11 a.m. to noon Pacific time, this show will bring on special guests that can inspire, educate, and in some cases, entertain while bringing answers and options to making things that can make your lives happier, healthier, and more successful. Now, Answers for the Family will address a variety of issues such as locating a runaway teen, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, dealing with addictions, and so much more. And we will introduce you to talented authors and new innovations in the areas of health, security, and fun for you and your family. Now, our topic today, which is also our guest's, the title of our guest's new book is Women's Empowerment and Global Health, a 21st Century Agenda. Now, for those of you that know me, you know that I have traveled all over the world. And unfortunately, I have seen the oppression of women. And it does exist, both women and girls. And it is a pervasive human rights violation with profound effects on their health and their well-being. Now, to talk about this and more, our guest, Sherry L. Dworkin, is a professor and associate dean of academic affairs at the University of California and co-founder and former deputy director of the University of California Global Health Institute Center for Expertise on Women's Health, Gender, and Empowerment. Sherry, welcome to Answers for the Family.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me.
Well, I got to tell you, I got the opportunity to go through the book, and I think you're really shining a light on a lot of things that I think many people in this country aren't even aware exists, or if they do, I don't think that they are paying attention or focusing on it. So I think first, if you can just tell us a little bit about what it is that you're doing at the university, some of the things that you are putting together that are helping on this very, very important subject.
Sure. Thanks so much for having me on the show. I really appreciate it. So I think it's really important to kind of pull back from my own work, because this book is actually a really interesting product of an entire research center. And so to understand the chapters in the book and the work that's being done in it and through it, it's really important to think about how the organizational context kind of emerged in the University of California system. So to be clear, the book is a product of the Center of Expertise on Women's Health, Gender, and Empowerment. And as you noted, the center really focuses on the links between women's empowerment and health. And the center is really unique because essentially it brings together a multidisciplinary network of experts from across all of the University of California campuses and departments, and there are 10 campuses, and it includes their global partners and really attempts to press the research and education forward on what's really become a capstone theme in the global health and development agenda, which is women's and girls' empowerment and health. And so the book is really a series of case studies which kind of features this work at the intersection of empowerment and health. And the book itself really emerged out of the vision of the previous director, who was Dr. Paula Tabro at UCLA. And she wanted the book to really help the public and help practitioners and teachers understand how to link empowerment and health, and to think about the ways through which, when you intervene on empowerment, you're actually intervening on health. And also the reverse is true. When you intervene on health, you can be intervening on empowerment. And she wanted to make sure that it wasn't just the voices of scientists that were featured. And she had the vision of examining the power of collaborations between community-based organizations and academia, or non-governmental organizations and academia. So the book is really interesting. It's helpful to practitioners. It's helpful to the public. It's a strong teaching resource. And it really crosses disciplinary boundaries, just like the center itself does. So it's really a pinnacle product of the center. And we pitched that idea with UC Press and talked about our ideas, and they loved the idea, and the book was born.
Well, I love the fact that it is very global. You know, I think often times somebody will attack a particular problem and they'll focus on right here. They'll focus on their local community, and not saying that we don't have problems here in our community, but I love the fact that it touches on problems, you know, all over the world. And in some cases, we have the same problems. In other cases, we have different ones. Share with us a little bit about, you know, what is your definition of empowerment for women, and show us how it ties into women's health.
Sure, that's the focus of the entire book, and it's a great question. Reading the book really gives you incredibly detailed answers to those questions. The key point of the book is that empowerment and health are synergistic. So, in other words, when you develop programs that are collaborations between community organizations and science-based university work, and you carry out work that changes women's inequitable situations, and you shift those situations to more empowering, then we can show how that shapes health. And at the same time, we're showing how when you act to improve women's health, this can have empowering effects. Now, your question about what empowerment is just, you know, an incredibly enormous question, and every discipline on the planet, you know, contributes to the answer, and they have a different definition of empowerment. And so what we did is ultimately anchor the entire book, the editors and the authors, around one definition as the basis for all of the case studies. And the definition is focused on Nalia Kabir's definition. She's actually an Indian-born British Bangladeshi social economist, and she has incredible expertise in poverty, gender, and social policy. And her work is actually from the development arena, and it was focused on empowerment, and it's now been applied to health in very interesting ways. And so that definition really focuses on how resources, and we define resources as income, property rights, job improvement, information, health services. And to be clear, these resources can be at any level, the community level, the organizational level, the family level, the small group level, or the individual level. And we show how resources shape an individual or collective body of people's ability to act in ways that really enhance their strategic life choices. And through that improvement in being able to act on your strategic life choices, that's what's meant by empowerment, and that in turn shapes health. So in many chapters of the book, we show directly how resources shape agency and empowerment, and how this in turn shapes health. Whether we do that through an analysis of economic empowerment in South Africa through microenterprise and gender empowerment training, or we look at Western Kenya and we look at access to and control over land and how property rights help to shape empowerment-related processes and reduce violence and HIV outcomes for women, or through a number of different chapters, we're really showing and anchoring that it is the pathway of resources to empowerment to improved health outcomes that really matters.
Now, you mentioned HIV, and you mentioned some countries that I have visited. Describe one of like the 13 multidisciplinary case studies that are included in the book, the Kenya example, for example, of access to land, or how how inevitable it is that it can reduce their risk of HIV and gender-based violence.
Absolutely. The project in Kenya is such an interesting one, not because it's my study, but because it's truly an interesting one. And I work in Western Kenya in rural areas, and the HIV rate is very high in the provinces where we work. And I learned that many women were actually thrown out of their homes and disinherited by their in-laws when their husbands passed away from HIV, even though their husbands may have brought HIV into the household. And what happened was, because women were disinherited and thrown out of the home, and because they didn't have firm grounding in having access to and control over the land was titled in the male name, they ultimately had to migrate, sometimes with their children and sometimes without them, if the family took them. And this migratory process really exposed them to, and others, to increased HIV risk. So what happens is, if you have a very high seroprevalence population, high rates of HIV, that are migrating and thrown out of their homes, of course they need food and shelter. And without their home of origin and without income, they're likely to take on additional sexual partners just to survive during the migratory process and then at the point of destination. So we really showed in this chapter how a grassroots property rights program, which helps to retain women in their home of origin and gain access to and control over the land in their home of origin, led to reduced violence and reduced HIV risks for women. And it also empowered the women to have a voice and a say in their families and communities. And it empowered them in a variety of ways, and the chapter really details that. So what the work is really trying to point out, and what the second half of the book is really trying to point out, is that there are these social and structural drivers of HIV risk, and when you intervene upon those structural and social drivers, you can actually impact both empowerment and health outcomes.
Yeah, and when you mentioned in regards to them taking on additional partners, and I think for our Western listeners, that isn't necessarily always by choice. I know that when I was over there, I was speaking to some people who talked about some statistics, and I believe one of them was that they were something like 20 times more likely to be raped while they are going through that migration. So I don't want people out there to think, oh, well, you know, they're just taking on partners because they're out and about. No, this is not something that they're choosing.
Right.
Would you agree with that?
I would, and I think that, you know, a lot of times the sex exchange is for survival. It's for food, it's for shelter, it's for clothing, which is why it's so important to think of property and land as something that's firmer and stronger than income, right? It's something that once you acquire access to more securely, it's a source of income. You can, in an agricultural society, grow crops on it and retain food and income for the family, and thus it's such a critical structural driver of reducing HIV risk to begin with. But I would agree certainly that this is what we would call either force or constraint and not, quote, choice.
Yeah, I know. Now, we have a listener question coming in. And again, I want to thank those that take the time to send us in these questions, in some cases before the show and in some cases during the show. This one reads, as a supporter of Planned Parenthood, I'm very upset that the organization is in serious jeopardy of losing its major funding to provide non-abortion services to low-income women. What is your organization's position on this and other women's medical support groups? And this is from Kathy in Los Angeles.
That's a great question. Family planning is actually a centerpiece of our center. So our core activities in both our research and our educational center focus on assuring safe motherhood globally, reducing violence against women, improving access to family planning and to other reproductive technologies, and advancing sexual and reproductive health. And of course, that includes preventing HIV and AIDS and also reducing environmental threats to women's health. So we are certainly along the lines of the listener who wrote in, because family planning is known to actually help women. Where our book is focused is in the Global South, but it's absolutely known to help women to space their pregnancies. Some of the areas in which we work, women have an average number of children between 6 and 8. There are actually negative health outcomes associated with not having access to family planning, and there are a host of other health and empowerment related issues linked to having control over your fertility. So we really do see this as both an empowerment and a health issue.
Now, I had noticed that the United Nations recently endorsed the Sustainable Development Goal 5. Share with our listeners exactly what that means to empowering women and to all of us.
So the ultimate goal is really in line with what we're talking about within the center. So it's really focused on the empowerment of women, and you'll see that in a number of the other goals that these are explicitly linked to health, but sometimes empowerment stands on its own. And it is curious that it stands on its own, but if you read about the definitions of what's meant, you can see that this is linked to improving socio-cultural valuations of women, improving the rights of women, and linking to safe motherhood and reducing violence against women and the reduction of HIV and AIDS. So this is really incredibly in line with some of our work, and we consider our work as catapulting that goal forward.
Well, I love the fact that the United Nations, that it isn't just coming from our country. It is obviously coming from, those leaders from many countries to shine a light on this. I know that there's a presidential task force as well. Share a little bit about what that task force is doing.
That is actually an initiative of the second UC Global Health Institute Center of Expertise on Women, Gender, and Empowerment. And essentially, the president of the UC system is really trying to catapult the strength of the 10 campuses to work system-wide across all of the campuses to prevent sexual violence against women and girls. So that involves, a thorough rewriting of policy, thinking about definitions of consent, thinking about reporting mechanisms and how to protect victims, and thinking about how we handle cases overall. And really, it's just an attempt to improve accountability and protection of victims and to help keep campuses safe, which is what parents, families, students, and local communities wish for at university campuses.
Yes, absolutely. So I know that that in the book there's sort of a unique feature that involves the media. Can you explain a little bit about that to our listeners?
Yeah, it's such an exciting feature of the book. Most books that kind of straddle academia and the public are often involve text, and it's really tough. Some people tell me to pick up a book and they'll say, why are there no pictures, or why isn't there this or that? And so we tried to correct that in a couple of ways. We produce lessons learned boxes in the book, for example. We want to show not just that programs work, but we want to help people to understand how they work, and we want people to understand the challenges and limitations associated with program development and implementation. So we tried to be really honest in the text about not just that things work or that they're going so well, but to detail really some of the nuances of the challenges and limitations of projects. The media portion that's so exciting is that we actually paid local filmmakers in 6 different countries to capture the programmatic work that was going on the ground, so that researchers, practitioners, the public, professors, teachers, learners could see videos associated with the rich, detailed work on the ground. And those films were edited, and when you purchase the book, you can see the videos, and they're actually featured on the UC Global Health Institute Center of Expertise on Women's Health, Gender, and Empowerment website. And I think that adds a lot to the chapters. So you can, you know, read about the development of the work, its implementation, the success stories, the limitations, but then you can click on a locally produced video that really shows you the rich context and some of the lively and dynamic social relations going on the ground within the project.
Now, is there anybody doing anything in regards to putting those videos together and trying to get it out to an even broader audience, to get it to, you know, to Netflix, to get it out to somewhere to where we can get it to where more people have access to it?
It's a great question. I think that's something we can work with the press on. We definitely have access to some of the videos on our website. We definitely have access to them through the purchase of the book. But it is tough to take kind of a decontextualized short video and watch it and get a full understanding of the project. It's a lot easier to do so if you sit down and actually read through the case studies, and they're very short, so that readers, you know, won't be put to sleep or get bored in any way. And the films really help to work in tandem with the written text to help garner a fuller understanding of the work.
Well, now we're going to take a break in a moment, but you mentioned the website. Can you give our listeners what the website is? And for those of you out there, if you're sitting at home or if you're sitting at your office, you can open up another window while we go to break so that you can follow along with some of the things that we're talking about. And what is that website, Sherry?
Sure. It's a little long, but folks can hang on to their hat and go for it. It's UCGHI. That stands for UC Global Health Institute. .universityofcalifornia.edu/COEs/women's-health/index.aspx. And I'm happy to forward that along. And you can see the multimedia is right on the homepage of the center's main page.
Okay, and that would be good. So after the show, if you can forward that along, what we will do, and for those of you that are out there driving, I know you couldn't get that anyway, but we'll put that on the Answers for the Family site so that if anybody wants to go to that site, again, if you wrote that down and you can go right now, please do while we take a break. If you didn't get it, that's fine. We'll have it on our site afterwards. So stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to Answers for the Family.
Founded over 30 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, West Shield has continually focused on resolving issues that negatively impact families and businesses. Our signature therapeutic transportation service helps to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely transported to specialized schools, programs, and treatment centers with unsurpassed experience and success. We are supported by our full-service, licensed investigation agency that has legally, professionally, and compassionately located hundreds of runaways and teens. We are experienced and qualified to help, offering solutions which may include referrals to our international network of top professionals in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, psychiatry, and investigations. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services and West Shield Investigations are the best solutions when your family is facing a personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. That's 1-800-899-8585, or visit our website at westshield.com. Thank you.
And we're back. You're listening to Answers for the Family, and we are talking about women's empowerment and global health. So, Sherry, I think as we were going to break, did you have a question or something that you wanted to share?
No, I was just unclear about the break. No problem.
Okay. So, you know, for us to be in a situation where we're talking about women's empowerment, I don't think we can have that conversation without really talking about gender power relations. So they seem to be central to gender inequality. So can you talk a little bit about the four pathways in regards to our gender power relations?
Yeah, in the text, we really focus quite a bit on four pathways that really shape inequality that you can intervene on to empower women. And we talk a little bit about discriminatory values, norms, practices, and behaviors. Those can be structured into policy or rights or the law. They can also involve human interaction and the way people see one another and perceive notions of inferiority and superiority. And of course, those beliefs and norms end up translating into practices and behaviors in everyday life. So that's an enormous one. That's not too different from what we just talked about when we talked about property rights. The interesting thing about property rights is that there's actually statutory law on the books that helps to protect women's access to and control over land, and yet it's more kind of customary law and day-to-day human interaction and processes that lead to the disempowerment of women, which leads to the disinheritance that I talked about previously. So when we talk about discriminatory values, norms, practices, and behaviors, we're talking about what's codified into law, rights, and human interaction more informally. And then, of course, there's differential exposures and vulnerabilities to disease. This isn't necessarily something that people think really carefully about, but if you just even take the simple example of thinking about gender divisions of labor in the household, in many of the areas where we work, for example, women are solely responsible for gathering water, for cooking food, for taking care of children, for cleaning the household, and even just being in the kitchen and experiencing all of the toxic smoke in the kitchens in some of these areas is actually a differential exposure that men don't experience in the home based on what we call the gender division of labor in the household. So it's really important to think about the ways in which work and family life and home life actually expose women and men to differential health exposures and vulnerabilities to disease. And of course, there's biases in health systems, just as there are biases in health systems that lead to the poor treatment of racial, ethnic minorities or sexual minorities. There's a really robust body of research that shows how women are actually treated differentially in the healthcare system in ways that can marginalize their health. And then finally, it's really important to put the reflective lens on ourselves. You know, there are biases in health research. For example, I wrote a piece many years ago, not in the not too distant past, but I wrote it about how we tend to assume that women are vulnerable to disease, and at times we can leave out an understanding of men and their vulnerability. And that kind of comes partly from empirical reality, but it also comes from the perception that men are strong and they're therefore not vulnerable, and thus that can find its way, unfortunately, into health research. So a lot of my own research has actually focused on how gender norms and practices actually can negatively shape men's health as well, and not just women. So it's really important to look at biases in health research itself, not just around women and their vulnerability, but the omission of men as well.
And I think to jump off from that last point that you just made, it's fascinating that you write that while men in these environments generally have greater control, because that's where we kind of started with this, is that, you know, they do have more power, but they have greater control and access to a variety of resources. But that it can also be damaging to men's own health and well-being, resulting in a narrowed environmental and cognitive experiences, including violence, substance abuse, and even premature death. So as you write your masculinities-based gender transformative health program show, that sets of the stages for women's health and empowerment alongside men's social transformation. So explain a little bit about that in regards to, you know, so that people will understand that making some of these changes, both domestically and worldwide, really does help all of us.
Absolutely. This is such a super interesting area of work. And masculinities and health, as I said, is actually a really strong area of expertise for me. And so as you point out, you're right. You know, while it's true that some men enjoy greater access to and control over a variety of resources, whether that's income or access to occupational status or a number of other resources, and they may be more empowered than women in many of the contexts in which we work, it is also the case, if you think about it, that men can at times adhere to some narrow and constraining ideas of what it means to be a man. And what's exciting in the global health research base and also the domestic research base is that we now know empirically that when men adhere to a very narrow and constraining view of what it means to be a man, we can show quantitatively that that's harmful to their health and to women's health. We can take some simple examples. I mean, everyone who's listening can probably understand and relate, right? For example, if men think it's a sign of weakness to go to the doctor, that simple internalization of the idea that masculinity shouldn't be equated with weakness or physical ailments, that basic internalization of a belief can actually lead to their poor health. And in fact, in my own research, this can have devastating consequences. For example, heterosexual men in sub-Saharan Africa are far more likely to die of HIV than are women, because women will receive care in health clinics when they're pregnant and they're far more likely to be tested, whereas men will be less likely to be tested. And when they do go to the doctor, they actually show up at a stage when HIV is very advanced. So there are a variety of areas in which the global health and domestic health arena has shown that helping men to critically reflect on these narrow and constraining ideas of masculinity can actually reshape their own health and their partner's health. Now, the piece you mentioned about gender transformation is really interesting, too. It's not just helping men to critically reflect on ideas about what it means to be a man if they're harmful in that man's particular life, but it also helps to shift men in the direction of more consultative decision-making. And we're finding that both domestically and globally, when you integrate those two lines of thinking into programs, helping men to critically reflect on their understanding of what it means to be a man, to improve their own health and their partner's health, and shift them in the direction of more consultative decision-making, we find that this actually improves women's empowerment and health, and it improves men's health. So it's a win-win.
And I love
this.
It
is a really exciting area of work. I've actually written a lot on it. I've written a systematic review on how these transformative programs work across a variety of health outcomes, and they've been quite successful. And I also recently wrote another book separately on this topic called Men at Risk.
Well, I mean, to me, it is such a fascinating subject and something that doesn't get out into the news enough. We don't hear enough about it. So I'm so glad that you're putting the information out there. We have another listener question, and this one reads, I am a member of a women's legal aid support group in Phoenix, Arizona. We deal with issues ranging from parental rights to job discrimination to insurance issues. I ordered your book this week and look forward to sharing it with my fellow associates as we continue to gain more insight on what is happening on the national and international scene. Increasing awareness is what we are all striving for. Thank you. And this is from Ariel. So thank you, Ariel, from Phoenix.
Yeah. It's fantastic. I wanna just highlight one other aspect. I mean, legal aid is so critical. In that example I gave previously around the property rights program in Kenya, but there's also another chapter in the book about land and property tenure and legal issues in Nicaragua. But the legal aid piece is just so critical. I mean, the Kenya chapter features how this group of grassroots women really became educated in the Constitution in their local context, and then they use the Constitution to actually informally mediate the property rights cases at the local level with chiefs and village elders and families. And they did this through this grassroots organization called Grassroots Women Organizing Together in Sisterhood. But the legal aspect of this and the need to educate women about their rights and about what the Constitution says in terms of land ownership and other issues was really a critical piece. And it was so inspiring to see women with actually very little education significantly bolster the capacity of both women and men in the community on these issues, and then to work to really informally mediate these cases. And sometimes they do go to court, but women in poverty and their families can't afford court, you know, in these contexts a lot of the time. So having these more informal educational processes and community-level justice can at times be very effective as an alternative to formal justice systems. So I really appreciate the comment and couldn't agree more that the legal realm is really critical in bolstering the capacity of people to understand their rights and realize their dreams.
Yeah, and I'd like to second that, because, again, some of the countries that I've been in, and I've met with some of the legal aid people that are there, and as you said, these grassroots organizations that are setting themselves up to be able to help, and usually if I'm there, it may be that there is an issue as it relates to human trafficking, and I will be going in there and not only educating them, but I will be speaking with law enforcement as well as the media to see if we can get them to all work together to be able to help these women and put them in a position to be able to succeed rather than to continue to be exploited. So yes, I second that. Without the people that are there, the legal people who are there staying with them and working with them, we wouldn't have the successes that we have had or made the progress that has been made in these areas.
I really like that example too, because it shows the power of a multi-sectoral response, right? It's not just area X or area Y. It's, you know, the conjoining of the two that really get you somewhere. And I think previously I had said, oh, the book is, you know, multidisciplinary or interdisciplinary, but you're right, it's also multisectoral, and it's really sustainable solutions, no matter what the issue is, definitely require multisectoral action. So the less we're siloed and the more we work together and across various sectors, the more sustainable our outcomes, I think. So it's really inspiring to hear about that work as well.
Yep, it's all about working together. We have another message that's coming in right now as we speak. And this one, I think, appears, I'm reading it as we go, and it seems to be referring to an earlier question. This one says, with the evidence that Planned Parenthood was involved in selling aborted fetuses and appeared to exploit rather than empower women, I would like to see our government provide funding for programs like yours that seems to truly provide empowerment and health education to all women. Has there been anything submitted to the legislature to provide more funding for your organization?
I'm not sure I understood the first part of the question, because it seemed to talk about some sort of mythology or lack of fact around, you know, what we understand as in the evidence base around Planned Parenthood. So I wasn't certain what the first part of the question meant.
I'm just saying, I think the first part of it, I think what they're suggesting is that whatever funding is going to Planned Parenthood should be going to you. And but I think the question that is geared towards you is has there been anything submitted to the legislature to provide more funding for your organization as they would like to see that happen?
That's really a nice comment. I think essentially, you know, the center is funded partly, of course, through government funds, since the UC system is, you know, a public institution. So, of course, some state funds go to our institution, as they do to any academic institution. We're also funded through, you know, a variety of sources, through grantsmanship, through foundation funding, through National Institute of Health grants, through a variety of sources. So we are certainly attempting to get the word out about our work so that we can bring even more recognition and resources to our group. And, of course, we'll continue to work very rigorously in writing our grants to all of those various sectors so that we can ensure our continued success. And we did, you know, survive the first 5 years of the center, and we morphed into a second center. So we're starting into our second five-year period of funding. So that's really wonderful to hear. And we've just kicked that off. So I think we'll be around for the foreseeable future, and we'll keep, you know, listening to the needs of the public and looking at the empirical research and seeing what women and girls need, both domestically and globally, and we'll respond to that.
Well, and I think to add to what that person was saying is there anything that the public can do? Is there anything that the people can do to tell their legislators, you know, that, you know, this is where we want to see our money going? We want to see this happen. You know, would that be something that would also be helpful?
Of course it's helpful. Yeah, the public has more power than they think they do in terms of advocating for things that matter to them. And there really is quite a bit of, you know, empirical evidence that really shows the benefits of intervening on these issues. And this is not fluff or ideology. Our center is actually really on the cutting edge of really producing and using and drawing upon hard quantitative measures of empowerment so that we can actually show that these programs matter in terms of what they're intervening on and what the ultimate outcomes are. So we're interested in not just producing an evidence base around advocacy, but also around the science base. And we think that has particular power, you know, with the legislature. At least we hope it does. I mean, not all of the legislature is interested in evidence, but if that's a particularly helpful angle to take, we can certainly help provide some of that evidence. And we actually have some really great papers on our website produced by a lot of the scholars around the center of expertise, so that folks can take a look and see more about what, you know, what's out there in the evidence base on some of these most cutting edge issues. And they really are recalcitrant to change unless we act consistently and act collectively. So of course we really appreciate folks writing to, calling, going to their legislators for this purpose.
Well, and we've got about 3 minutes left, but what I would like to do is I'd like to wrap up and have you tell us about the parts of the book that relate to women empowerment and health here in the United States. What are some of their deficiencies here, and what can be done practically and through federal and state legislatures to attack these problems? And to add to that, has the new administration taken action that will either hurt or help in this regard?
Wow, that's a tough and powerful question. I really appreciate it. The book itself is mostly focused on global health. Of course, the United States is part of global health, so there are a few case studies in the U.S., although as you pointed out at the outset of the show, there are a lot of issues within the book itself that do matter for women in the United States, or at least particular populations or regions in the United mm-hmm. States. We do have a couple chapters focused on the U.S. We're focused on U.S. women with HIV, and we are also focused on older U.S. women's economic security. And that piece is on economic security, is written by Carol Estes. And it's also about kind of political and economic questions about whether some politicians even view women as deserving of health care, Medicare, or Social Security. And economic disadvantage is really critical to think about in terms of Social Security, Medicare, and health care, and because the economic disadvantage really accumulates over the life course and impacts women's health and empowerment, and women's economic security and health are actually threatened by stakeholders who attempt to undermine or dismantle Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, or even the Affordable Care Act. So there is a really interesting and important case study within the book, which really talks about a movement that's designed to counteract and resist attempts to dismantle these really important social contracts, or, you know, what we call the grand bargain that congressional conservatives and the president really make together, that would, quote, reform Social Security and Medicare. But as the book points out, these can really undermine and harm women's economic security, empowerment, and health. So that is a very critical issue for us to think about in the U.S. as the, you know, current president thinks through the dismantling of healthcare as it stands, and also thinks through or makes plans with Paul Ryan to think through, you know, Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, either within the Affordable Care Act or otherwise. So that set of actions that seem to be moving forward right now would be very challenging for women, especially elderly women and poor women. But there are a number of areas that the new administration is stepping into that are also kind of fascinating in this regard. For example, you know, comments from the recent vice president about, you know, contraception kind of being a liberal technology, which, you know, contraception is really helping women to space the timing of their families to in order to make strategic life choices. And globally, you know, condoms help provide prevention from not only pregnancy, but HIV
and disease, exactly.
Domestic instances and disease. So there are some areas that we hope the current administration certainly improves upon. And if they don't, I'm sure there'll be many organizations, including our own, that will continue to bolster our work.
All right. Well, Sherry, thank you so much for coming on. And thank you so much. I just want to take this time to really acknowledge you for all of the great work that you're doing. Really, if anybody can take one message home from this, can you take the message home that empowering women empowers all of us? That's what, you know, to our listeners. So again, thank you, you know, and just keep up the good work.
Thanks to you, and thanks to your listeners as well. Have a great rest of the day.
Thank you. You too. Okay. And for everybody out there, please be sure to put us on your calendar and tune in next Monday, the 24th, when we're joined by Britton Devereaux, Chief Clinical Officer of Demora Healthcare, as she discusses the topic, The Alchemy of Pain, Celebration, and Awakening. And if you missed or you want to share our show with your friends, please visit answersforthefamily.com or catch our latest shows on iTunes, where if you leave a review, it will greatly increase our iTunes ranking and help us to expand our reach to more families in need. You may also subscribe or resubmit your name to download your free copy of The Attitude of Gratitude Journal, your 21-day guide to achieving the quality of thankfulness through self-discovery. And remember, be good human beings and do something to make a positive difference in someone's life today. Thank you.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Matt Polacek, only on LA Talk Radio.